As Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump traverse the Keystone State, they're not agreeing on much. But when it comes to international trade, both candidates and attendees at their respective rallies get all riled up. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Both Clinton and Trump say the U.S. needs to renegotiate trade deals to bring back manufacturing. But Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff says that might not be the whole story.
On a Friday night in Altoona, the Blair County Convention Center was packed to the rafters with Trump supporters. There was an overflow room downstairs and a crowd outside that couldn't get in. He discussed everything from ISIS to Supreme Court justices, but it was talk of jobs that got the crowd excited.
We are not going to let your jobs leave, folks. We're not going to let it happen. They're not going to Mexico. They're not going anywhere else.
Like many Pennsylvania cities, Altoona has been on a slow decline for decades. Factories have closed, industry has left, and the railroad city is now classified as distressed by the state. Trump gave the crowd a clear solution and culprit for this decline.
We're going to renegotiate trade deals. NAFTA, signed by Bill Clinton, is a disaster. It's a disaster.
Trump is referring to the 1993 North American Free Trade Agreement, negotiated by President George H.W. Bush and signed by Clinton, which opened the doors for trade between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. NAFTA, along with other trade issues like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and admitting China to the World Trade Organization, get a lot of flack from Trump and his supporters. After the rally, Alan McManus, an Altoona native, said he supported renegotiating our trade deals.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. If you don't, then what jobs aren't going to come back here? People are still going to go cross seas or even in Mexico and start building their businesses.
Trump isn't the only candidate bashing trade deals. Hillary Clinton has distanced herself from NAFTA and reversed her support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, saying the U.S. is getting the short end of the stick. In Scranton, she outlined her 5-point economic plan, including this.
We're going to crack down on companies that ship jobs and profits overseas.
Clinton's supporters, like Trump's, are catching the theme. Bad times have bad trade deals to blame. But in Pennsylvania, a lot of manufacturing jobs were lost well before NAFTA. They went to the Sun Belt, where labor wasn't unionized, or they fell victim to automation. Mauro Gillen, a professor at the Wharton School of Business, says international trade is just part of a modern economy.
Certain kinds of jobs, right, in certain industries like metals, steel, auto parts, would have gone somewhere else in the world if it weren't Mexico. And let's also keep in mind that there's been a lot of jobs created in the United States as a result of NAFTA.
But those new jobs aren't always in the same place as the old jobs, and they often require a higher education. For example, new jobs in the tech sector and even advanced manufacturing often require at least an associate's degree. Faribor's Gadar, a professor at the Smeal School of Business at Penn State, says Pennsylvania hasn't responded well to those challenges.
Particularly in rural Pennsylvania, 45% of the adults today have no more than a high school degree. This presents a difficulty if you want to compete in the newer jobs.
Gadar says those who are qualified and able leave the state, finding work in areas that have benefited from trade. Those who remain behind feel shut out of the global economy, because in many ways, they are.
The issue is not really whether we have a bad deal. It's that what are we going to do for the people who don't benefit from the trade deal?
The answer, then, is not to bring steel mills and textile factories back to Pennsylvania, but rather to create advanced manufacturing opportunities and a workforce to match. The candidates are aware of that. Clinton plans to offer debt-free college and workforce training, as well as what she calls the largest investment in good-paying jobs since World War II. Trump intends to cut taxes for businesses and middle-class Americans, which he says will rev up job creation. But even if the anti-trade rhetoric is oversimplified and the effect of NAFTA a net gain for the nation, it's always good for a cheer in Pennsylvania, where convention centers are full of those left behind. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
The U.S. Department of Citizenship and Immigration Services is seeing an increase this year in foreign-born residents who've become naturalized citizens of the United States. Some of them were spurred on by the urgency to vote in the upcoming election, as WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
I hereby declare an oath.
On Monday morning, in a federal building in West Philadelphia, 51 people from 32 countries took the oath to become naturalized U.S. citizens. Jane Cowley of the Department of Citizenship and Immigration Services says most of these people are motivated by a desire to get a good job and to vote.
I think for many people, being able to apply for a federal job, being able to vote, are usually the big reasons why people become citizens. But once you become a citizen through the naturalization process, you have all of the rights and responsibilities that all natural-born citizens have, other than being able to run for president.
Already this year, more than 609,000 people have become American citizens. That's an uptick over last year. There was a similar increase 8 years ago in front of President Obama's first win in 2008. But Cowley cannot directly attribute these increases to election cycles. The numbers vary widely year to year, and the reasons why people choose to become citizens are not recorded.
Congratulations, you are now citizens of the United States.
One of those new citizens is Simon Firth. He co-owns a bike shop in the Fishtown neighborhood.
Best bike shop in Philadelphia. You can edit that out.
After his swearing-in ceremony, he and his wife, Vicky, had breakfast in a diner at the Reading Terminal.
Because what is more American than a diner?
22 years ago, Firth left London to visit friends in the States who were squatting in San Francisco. He never went back.
My status in America was not on, shall we say, solid ground at that point. So that's when we got married and applied for the green card and got the green card. And then we've been married for 17, 18 years, bought three houses, started a business. It's time to get involved in the political system, I suppose.
Firth says he started thinking about becoming a citizen because, as a small business owner, he wants to have a say in local elections. But the upcoming national election cinched the deal.
Do you read the papers? If I'm going to vote, this is the one, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I should be voting in all elections. They're all important. And watching on the sidelines has been upsetting. When I was in England, I would vote. As soon as I was 18, I voted. I didn't vote for Margaret Thatcher. If that is any indication of which way I'll be voting this time, I don't know.
Firth had to sit on the sidelines and just watch as England pulled out of the EU as part of the recent Brexit vote. He was surprised and dismayed at that result, and he wanted to be sure he was part of the next big decision in American politics. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
After a young Phillies fan was hit in the face by a line drive foul ball during Saturday night's game, there was a renewed call to install more protective netting to safeguard spectators at Citizens Bank Park. Let's look into the matter with Inquirer Phillies beat writer Matt Gelb. Matt, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
What is the incidence of fans getting injured at ball games, both at Citizens Bank and throughout Major League Baseball?
Well, you know, it's not as high as we would be led to believe. I mean, certainly the higher profile incidents are more publicized. There was an incident last year at Fenway Park in which a woman was severely injured by a foul ball. But, you know, the predominance is that the foul balls are usually caught or miss the fans. It is very rare in which someone is actually injured by one.
Well, Matt, the problem is apparently pervasive enough that Major League Baseball offered recommendations last winter. What did they recommend?
Well, you know, they recommended that teams expand their netting. And actually, there are three teams in baseball that did expand their netting beyond the dugouts. Most teams chose to expand the netting behind the backs up to the edge of the dugout or a little bit over the dugouts.
Why did Major League Baseball put this out in the form of a recommendation rather than a mandate?
Well, I think every ballpark is different, and also they've decided that, you know, every fan base is different, and they're going to leave it up to their clubs to make some of these decisions. And they didn't want to impose a universal rule because they knew that there would be some blowback from it, and there has been. I mean, actually, there is a large amount of people who don't want to see the netting, and I think, you know, there was something very similar that happened in the NHL years ago when there was a young girl who was killed by a puck that came into the stands, and that did force the NHL to impose upon the teams certain netting requirements. And Major League Baseball has not reached that point yet, and you have to hope that similar incident than what happened in Columbus in the NHL is not what forces them to do that. But, you know, now that there is definitely more focus on the issue and perhaps more teams will begin to explore more netting.
Given the proximity to the action, these are not the cheap seats. So where do fans line up on the issue of netting?
Well, there's two different sides, and I think there's one side, a very vocal side, that will say, just pay attention to the game. If you pay attention to the game, these incidents are preventable. In certain cases, they're not. For example, Saturday night, when you're talking about a young girl who's sitting with her family, there wasn't a lot of reaction time, and they do pay a lot for those seats. So it is definitely an issue that is a challenging one for every club.
Though you've hinted that it might take a horrible accident and the then resultant lawsuit to force baseball teams to comply, is there fine print on the back of the ticket that warns fans that this is a necessary risk of the game, of attending?
Yep, and before every game, there are warnings issued from the public address announcer, and even people are familiar if they're at the ballpark, they see the signs that say "Watch for batted balls." But it's a shame that it has come to this, because certainly with the higher velocities that we're seeing from pitchers on the mound has resulted in more harder hit balls, and certainly that has translated also to harder hit foul balls, and players are stronger than ever. The ball is being thrown harder than ever, and the ball is traveling at a harder rate than ever. So it has created an issue here, and certainly one that players have noticed too. And I think that's what made Freddie Galvis's sort of comments, his strong comments, that they were very interesting. And it's hard to tell a player that it's not his fault, because, while they do know that, they weren't trying to hurt anybody on purpose and they weren't trying to hit it that way, they're trying to hit it in play, they do certainly feel some sort of part of responsibility there because they hit the ball. And I think players would be much happier if that sort of part of the equation was removed, and that they didn't have to worry about injuring someone with a foul ball. And certainly you could tell that Galvis was affected by it Saturday night. He stared into the area where the fan was for a while when the inning ended. He didn't take any warm-up tosses at shortstop. He sort of just stared over to the stands. He was very affected by it, and I think that showed in his comments saying that fans, the priority should be to protect fans.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Yeah, no problem.
Inquirer Phillies beat writer Matt Gelb. Still ahead, what's so special about a chunk of ice out beyond Neptune? This.
It orbits clockwise, so it orbits backwards from all the other planets of the solar system.
We'll hit the spin cycle when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. The recording industry is one casualty of our online world. Since the 1990s, many record labels have folded or consolidated as listeners turn to digital downloads and free music on YouTube rather than buying albums. But one local ensemble is bucking the trend. The Prism Quartet has launched Zoss Records with an album entitled The Curtis Project. Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas gave it a listen.
These days, you wouldn't think of record companies as part of a growth industry. But when members of the Philadelphia-based Prism Quartet decided to start Zoss Records, they felt that running the whole show themselves wasn't that great a leap.
Artists often take all of the risk when they're working with professional labels.
Matt Levy plays tenor saxophone with the Prism Quartet.
So the artists will pay for the entire gamut of expenses related to making a record. Artist fees, production fees, manufacturing. We sort of decided we would kind of cut out the middleman.
And Prism already had the content for the new label's first offering, stemming from a residency at the Curtis Institute of Music.
David Ludwig, who's the Dean of Artistic Programs, invited us to work with the composition department, and we wanted to include a program that featured 5 new works by composition students, as well as a new work by David called Joscan Microludes.
The project also included some star power, with a piece by Jennifer Higdon. The Curtis alum and Pulitzer Prize-winning composer wrote short stories for Prism to perform at branches of the Free Library of Philadelphia, where the audience makeup was unpredictable.
The idea was just to create a bunch of short movements that could be contained, moved around in any order, so that they could be fit anywhere you need it, including you got a raucous bunch of 8-year-olds running around the room. Or if you want something more calm and peaceful, there was an option for that as well.
The Curtis Institute is best known for educating world-class orchestral players. This new recording showcases another side of the venerable institution as a center for music composition.
Although it's ironic, because if you look at the list of people who graduated from the school, I think composers constitute the largest number of famous individuals coming out of there. I know Leonard Bernstein was He studied composition, but he also studied conducting. But Samuel Barber, Giancarlo Minotti, George Rochberg, composers, they're such a quiet entity. We're not on the stage except on the page.
The Prism Quartet will follow the release of the Curtis Project with another album of saxophone quartets and a collaboration with the percussion ensembles Parch and So Percussion. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
A newly discovered chunk of ice out beyond Neptune is more evidence in the cold case regarding the composition and behavior of our solar system. Joining me with the latest in the ongoing investigation, Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, it is merely a chunk in terms of solar system scale.
And it is icy, but the case is heating up all the time for a better understanding of what the solar system really is. This particular object, 124 miles in size, but it's really the orbit of this particular object and a few others that seem to have these odd orbital characteristics.
What is the rule before we discover what's odd?
Well, the rule sort of is that in the early history of solar systems, angular momentum in the formation of the star and the rest of the material forces that material into an orbit around the star, so that the planets all orbit in the same direction and they all orbit in the equatorial plane of the star. If you could look down on our star from space, look down from above onto what we might call the north pole of our star, we'd see that all the planets of our solar system orbit counterclockwise. But this object is very, very different. It's not in the plane of our solar system. It's off by 110 degrees. And the other thing is that it orbits clockwise, so it orbits backwards from all the other planets of the solar system.
So is it then necessarily an interloper?
Either it was captured by our solar system and pulled into this odd orbit, or some other sort of interaction occurred to cause it to tilt into this particular orientation and direction of orbit.
In this case, does ice mean ice?
So in the case of frozen objects in our solar system, particularly objects like this, when we say ice, more than likely we've been talking about hunks of frozen carbon dioxide mixed with dust and dirt and other detritus left over from the beginning of the solar system. It's always possible that this is something that has come from that cloud of objects that surrounds our solar system called the Oort cloud, and this somehow got pulled into this very odd orbit.
Let's do some more modeling, in this case, a scale analysis between the size of the sun and the size of the moon.
Yes, it's an interesting comparison. You know, the sun is 400 times larger than the moon in diameter. And because the moon orbits the Earth essentially once every month on a tilted orbit, every once in a while, a particular point in the moon's orbit lines itself up in a direct line between the sun and the Earth. And when it does so, at that particular point, the moon actually looks in the sky to be almost exactly the same size as the sun.
Hey, are we talking about an eclipse?
Yes, we're talking about a situation in which all three objects are lined up in such a way that the moon's shadow actually falls on the surface of the Earth, and we have what's called an eclipse. A total eclipse is a situation in which the entire sun is covered by the moon, and next year, we have a really wonderful instance in which a total solar eclipse will be visible all across the continental United States. The eclipse takes place August 21st of next year. The eclipse path begins out in the Pacific Ocean adjacent to Oregon, and then the shadow comes across the mid portion of the United States and goes off the coast in the state of South Carolina, meaning that this will probably be one of the most observed solar eclipses in the history of the world.
What will it look like from here?
Well, there's a difference. That path of totality is only about 60 miles wide, so that means that those of us here in the Delaware Valley will only see a partial eclipse. We'll be at 79%. It may seem as if there's a very thin, slight cloud cover obscuring the sun, very, very thin. But otherwise, if you didn't know there was an eclipse, you wouldn't realize that an eclipse is happening.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Space is the place, yeah.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Brett Rader, and Ty Johnson. Find us on iTunes, or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Space is the place. Yeah. Space.